Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's August 17th, 2014, and welcome to episode 81 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, all that good old nerd stuff, and I am joined, as always, with some good old nerds. And I will introduce them to you now. First up, he only has one initial, so he repeats it. It's Earl Evans. Hello, Earl.
Hello, Carrington.
We also have a fellow with two initials, and they are pronounced when put together. It is Paul Hagstrom. Hello, Paul.
Greetings.
And then we come back to the single initials, which makes both you and Earl sound sort of like secret superheroes. It is Michael Mulhern. Hello, Michael.
Hey, Shazbot.
Oh, that's sad. Too soon.
No. In memory, a sad loss.
And speaking of memory, today we are going to remember, see what I did there, the year 1981. As we began in our last episode, episode 80, we are going to take quick looks at the equivalent year in the 1980s of our podcast number. Boy, that was an awkward way to say that. But those of you listening will probably figure it out. This is episode 81, and so we are talking about milestones of 1981. And I'm going to throw one general one out there first, and then we can see what you guys remember or want to bring up about the year. The thing, when it comes to retro computing, the thing that strikes me most about episode 81 is the first thing I've thrown here in our show notes, which is that there was a veritable explosion of new microcomputers. It is crazy the number and range of computers that were released in 81. We have the Osborne 1, the Sinclair ZX81, the VIC-20, the BBC Micro, Texas Instruments put out the TI-99/4A, the IBM PC debuted, and so did the Xerox 8010, the Star Information System. Oh, how I do love that, although I've never had my hands on one. So it was quite the year for variety and a number of companies throwing their hats in the ring, trying to become what IBM did become, the dominant microcomputer system. So of that list that I just threw out there, how many of you back in the day, in the 80s, had any of these? Let's start with you, Earl. Did you have any of those in your eager hands back in the 80s?
I did. The Commodore VIC-20 is the first computer that I owned. I had a chance to touch most of these in the 8-bit retail world. All strangely except the IBM PC. Well, never a BBC Micro either, because I wasn't across the pond. But yeah.
Yep. So you, including the Xerox, you got your hands on that?
Did I? It seems like I saw one.
I'm jealous.
And I'm trying to remember how that could have been possible. But, you know, we get old and memories fade.
Yes, indeed. And what about you, Paul? Any of those, were they young Paul? Did he have his hands on those?
Well, I had, I guess I had a friend who had a PC in the early days. most of those, no. I did actually have a BBC Micro. I think I've related that a couple times. Over a summer, I borrowed one. It was, I guess, a North American version. As I recall, it also didn't have a disk drive, so I was kind of stuck with typing things in, you know, seeing the graphics and the colors and playing around with it, but then not actually being able to save it for any future use. So, But yeah, and I actually kind of liked the look of those. But it was kind of a fun thing because it was because I was already kind of in the Apple II world. But this was another. I think I'm pretty sure it's a 6502. No, am I wrong? Maybe. No, I think I am wrong. But at any rate, it was interesting to see sort of have another sort of foreign system.
Foreign. And speaking of foreign, Michael, what about you? Did you have any of those back in the day?
Well, the Sinclair ZX81 was one that I had actually seen and used. It was belonged to a friend he brought along to university. I suppose there was a bit of showing off with that. VIC-20, another mate of mine had the VIC. The others, I'm aware of them. The Osborne, I didn't really get to play with an Osborne until later on when someone bought one into a shop where I was working, but that was a couple of years down the track. But by that time I'd 81, started university, and I was programming on a mid-range box in Fortran and had just discovered the School of Business and School of Science Apple Computer Lab. So I'm about to embark on the slippery slope of computers on Apple IIs, or Europluses, actually.
Well chosen, you. For me on that list, the one that really stands out isn't one that I ever, back then or even since, have had my hands on, which is the Xerox Star. And as I put here in the show notes, to me, it looks like a glimpse of the future in 1981 terms. Like, we're dealing here with a computer that has a bitmap screen, a mouse, WYSIWYG word processing, laser printer, Ethernet, text and graphics mixed in the same document. I mean, just crazy. It is the computer that I would one day later be using, just with a different brand. And of course, the $17,000 price tag that goes with it in 1981 terms, which is probably the reason why it was something that looked like the future, but was nothing I was going to get my hands on at the time.
I think it must have been something else that I saw, because the retail stores that I would frequent were not equipped for something like a super high-end business machine like this. The Star was... I don't even know how many of those wound up selling. There weren't very many, right?
No, I think very few. And none of them to me. So what else in 1981 strikes you guys? Let's go around the table and see what are your memories of 1981. Earl, why don't we come back and start with you again? What does 1981 evoke for you?
Well, aside from the fact that I graduated from high school that year and therefore lost access to some computers, actually, I think one of my fondest memories was the Osborne 1. When that thing came out, interestingly, everybody talks about the form factor, the tiny little screen and that kind of thing. But back in the day, the most noteworthy thing about that computer was the pile of software that it shipped with. This was one of the first occasions where a vendor said, hey, we're not just going to sell you a computer as part of the package deal. We're going to give you all of the stinking business software that you could possibly need to run with the computer. And that was a big deal. So for the price, I think, wasn't it $17.95 for one of the Osborne ones? That it was actually a really good deal when you factored in all of those packages.
You could get 9 of those for the cost of one Xerox Star. another thing that always jumps out to me is, which affected me in a sense, because I had had an early TRS-80 Model 1. 1981 is the year that stopped being produced. And really the reason was the new FCC regulations. So all these new computers came in and they had to essentially... The goal was to stop making them make your radio not work if it was near your computer. They were just causing all kinds of interference all over the place, and the Model 1 could not be retrofitted with any sort of cage around it that would stop that. So Tandy basically said, well, that's it for the Model 1, and that's essentially what killed the run of that, is the new FCC regulations. And Paul, what about you? What does 1981 evoke for you?
Well, for me, actually, if we're talking about actual memories, I don't have many computer related ones, because that would have been basically the time when I was just being introduced to computers at all, and so I saw Apple II in the elementary school. That was about it. 1981, is that right? I don't know. I guess it was something like 10. But at any rate, but there were a couple of things. So maybe I'll take the Apple III re-release, which I was not aware of at the time, but is one of the things that happened in 1981. Apple had released the Apple III and had huge problems with it, and sort of renewed their vows in late 1981 to try to kind of like reintroduce it with new software and things. So that, you know, sort of pertinent to me. Another thing that I found was DBase 2 apparently shipped in 1981, and that's kind of that had a big impact.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty interesting actually reading about DBase 2 because I didn't know much about it, but apparently there was no DBase 1. It's DBase 2 just sounded a little bit more stable, so they just picked the name. And apparently Ashton Tate, who is the company that produced it, there is a Tate, but there is no Ashton. They just made that up because it sounded
really
better.
I yeah. never knew that. I never knew any of that. That's so funny. I did use DBase, you know, for many, many years in different versions, but I never knew that about Ashton Tate. I assumed there was both an Ashton and a Tate.
Nope.
That's very funny.
And there kind of was, in a sense, a DBase 1, but they didn't call it DBase 1. The fella who designed it, whose name escapes me now, had worked for Jet Propulsion Laboratories.
It was Ashton.
No.
I was going to say, did it implode and suck him out of the timeline?
It seems like it was Wayne for some reason. I can Google that. But the interesting thing, yeah, is that they decided, let's just go with 2 because it sounds more mature and business people like mature. But there actually was a precursor product. It just wasn't something that they had offered for sale.
Right. I think I read up a little bit on it. And the Wayne thing is right. I forget, but I don't remember the other part of the name and which part that is. But I think the previous product was called Vulcan, maybe.
Yes. And C. Wayne Ratliff is the name of the fella.
So there's no Ashton, but there is a C. Wayne Ratliff? Okay, sure. Why not?
Yeah, I think marketing won on that one.
And Michael, what about you? What does 1981 evoke for you?
Well, 1981, that was the year which I actually got hands-on with computers. 1980, finished high school. 81, off to university. As I said earlier, I was started off Fortran programming, first on Markstens, then punch cards, using a Textronix vector workstation for some engineering, terminals for statistic courses, and then I found the Apple II lab, and it was down the rabbit hole from there. But 1981 was also the year that Wizardry was released. Proving Grounds of the Mad Overlord, one of my all-time favorite 8-bit computer games. And that sparked off for me a whole love of those styles of games. It also coincided with the fact that I was heavily into D&D at that stage, and it was interesting to sort of have a computer adjunct to role-playing, and it was a very interesting time where this was all coming together.
Awesome. It's funny how in today's terms, I think people don't realize exactly how big Wizardry was and for how long. If you pull out magazines from the 80s, even years later, there will be large ads about Wizardry, about utilities that can, you know, modify maps or restore characters or change characters. For years on, it was just an insanely large franchise.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things that really got me into the programming. It was pulling games apart. So there were the basic games that we could literally pull apart. But Wizardry, a couple of us started writing whole of disk sector editors. We were able to go in to the structures of the disks. We were writing those whole of disk based utilities before they were pretty much generally available. And we decided that we would write a specific Wizardry editor based on that. So there were some very interesting games. Tilt-A-Weight basically had no meant no danger to us. Wizardry fans will understand a tilt-a-weight, but we had lots of fun going in and decoding the character structure, the format structure of those discs, and we came up with some quite good disc utilities, and it was all driven by wanting to get in and see how the game worked.
One thing that I might add about Wizardry, just because it's kind of salient for me now, is they did a really good job of copy protecting that disc.
Yeah.
I have a couple of them, and I've been trying to get images of them, and boy, they did a really good job. Even right there at the beginning of the copy protection, they managed to. It's one of the standard discs I'm using when I'm testing my utility to see if it can get the image right. And so far, I haven't gotten Wizardry to work, but it's one of the goals.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. Although you can get disc images that have been cracked and play them on the emulator, it's the fact that my characters, I need to, I would love to drag them off a disc. Well, to start with, I'd like to see, make sure that the disc is working. I haven't wanted to boot up that copy of the scenario disc, which has got the characters on it, just in case something bad happens to it. Mm-hmm. But yes, we spent many an hour playing Wizardry. We even played it D&D style, so that you'd have two, three, even the full complement of characters, and we'd all be discussing what would be need to be done, where to go. One or two would be doing the mapping, so it was quite an interesting style of play. We had been heavily into various RPGs, and we basically played Wizardry as a group RPG, and it was great. The heady 80s.
Indeed, very nice. Another thing to do with discs that always comes up, comes up when I think of 1981, and is I think of this as totally an era of the 5 1/4-inch disc. I mean, that's it. It was years later that I started using 3.5-inch discs, but it turns out that Sony actually shipped the first 3.5-inch floppy discs. Or floppy drives in 1981. And this is something else I didn't know. There were still competing standards, 3-inch, 3 1/4, 3.9-inch. All four of these were so-called standards until the following year when essentially the 3.5 won out, although it was years later before I ever had a drive like that.
Yeah, I was aware of the 3-inch form factor, but not of the 3 1/4 and the 3.9. And yeah, it wasn't until I bought my Apple IIc and bought the external drive for it that would have been 84, late 84, that I had my first 3.5-inch drive. But I agree. I still feel that the 80s was the age of the 5 1/4-inch disc. I think it was more pervasive than the 3.5 was on the horizon.
For me, it was my first Macintosh because it came with a 3.5-inch disc drive built in. And so that was the first time I ever used one. And I felt that even at the time, it seemed like a kind of controversial choice to pick the 3.5 instead of what I considered the standard floppy size.
I like the 3.5 because from my university experience, we were just chucking the floppy disks into our satchels, and sometimes even not finding the cover slip for the 5 1/4 meant that they went in naked. But with we liked the 3.5s that with the metal shutter on it, we thought that they were a lot more student safe.
Oh, I completely agree. I became a big fan of the 3.5-inch, absolutely. But I'm the sort of person who never really even embraced ProDOS for the Apple, so I was very much old school when it came to my floppy use.
No, same here. I'm only just starting to learn ProDOS now.
Still seems like a pain.
I don't know. Give me a flat single structure disk.
These drives are so big that I need anything more than that.
Directories and folders, they just get in the way.
Totally. Completely agree. Even today. So anybody else? Who else has something to chime in about for 1981? Earl, you've got something. I know you do.
Yeah.
There's
something that's been missed, I think.
Did we miss something? What did we miss? Tell me.
MS-DOS released.
Oh, that little tiny piece of software no one's heard of.
We wrote it down in our notes. We're just skirting around it.
I thought you meant something important.
Right.
Yeah, interesting. The whole MS-DOS thing. I think we've pretty much covered that one to death in terms of the history of that being bought from Seattle Computer Products mm-hmm. and, you know, the whole episode of how that wound up becoming the operating system for the IBM PC instead of CPM.
Yeah, the start of the Leviathan.
There's just there's so much to talk about there that I'm not going to talk about any of it.
That'll show it.
That sounds wise. This one actually, I'm looking at the, you know, I'm gesturing toward our show notes.
We can all see that.
Yeah, the Hayes AT command set is in this list as a 1981 innovation.
Oh, that was a game changer. Totally.
That's really quite something. So,
and the Hayes smart modems themselves were just a beautiful device. They were priced beautifully too, as if, you know, like you're buying something beautiful and we're going to price it so you know it. But really, really good quality systems. I love the fact that they put them in those little stackable things, and they came up with a couple of other things that you could stack on top, but nobody really bought them all that mm-hmm. much. But just what do you guys think of the industrial design of the old Hayes smart modems? They just seem beautiful to me.
I love flashing lights.
I was always a big fan.
I quite like them. I actually missed all the interaction with the, well, not that much interaction, the flashing lights when the modems went basically internal, when they were basically just a card and slotted in into your PC. I did kind of miss all the blinking lights.
Yeah, me too. And also, I was always just a little bit suspicious of internal modems because I thought if I changed the type of computer that I'm working on, then all of a sudden my modem's not going to be any good anymore. But that was when we're talking about this Cambrian explosion of computing, you know, like there's 100 different models. Pretty soon that came to be a non-issue, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I was completely a Hayes smart modem guy early on, very much so. Love the industrial design. Love that metal like box they're in with the line of white lights in the front. I really only switched brands eventually to US Robotics. So eventually in the sort of the later modem era, I used those. And I only used modem cards for, I think, one instance. I ran a BBS off an Apple 2GS, and so I had modem cards and phone cards in that to bring in a bunch of different lines. It was a four-line BBS, so I need to be able to answer through four different telephone lines. And so I think that's the only time. I think that was on a 2GS. It might have been on an early Mac. I don't even remember now. And then eventually it was just serial ports and things were, and modems were built onto motherboards, and I basically stopped buying them.
Kind of fascinating. I don't know the history of Hayes. I don't know. I mean, at one point they were the 800-pound gorilla in that space.
It was actually Ashton Hayes who invented this. Little known fact.
Very nice. And then they lost the momentum, right? They just kind of mm-hmm. trailed off. Yeah, I don't know what happened.
It dropped
there.
Carrier.
Pretty much that's when, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. No carrier.
That's where I think US Robotics sort of came in and became the new gorilla on the block.
I wonder if it was just the pricing structure. You just couldn't keep pricing premium like that when you've got all these discount manufacturers. Like, gosh, at one point, there are just tons of people in the modem game. I mean, I can think of five or six different discount modem manufacturers myself. So maybe that's what got them. It's just, you know, couldn't keep up with the discounts and the imports.
Yeah, but the AT command set, which is theirs, just was such a the 800-pound gorilla of modeming. I mean, it just became the standard.
Yeah, that's like the Centronics printer port and other mm-hmm. things like that, right? You know, you'd never actually heard that much about Centronics making printers, which they did, but you certainly heard about the Centronics printer port standard.
Exactly, so. Yeah. So that was 1981, a fine year for computing. but as is 2014, and the retro computing love continues, so we're going to go on now to our items of news and interest and such. And let's kick it off with Paul, whose initials, I remind everyone, are F. So Paul, what is this interview that you want to bring up?
Well, this is an interview that was done in 1979 with Ted Nelson, and I'm actually not sure of the source of the interview. But I think it also was on CBC, but it was sort of part of a retrospective on, you know, interesting old interviews. But it's an audio. It's basically, I think, a 15-minute audio interview with Ted Nelson, where Ted is basically just trying to, you know, make the case for putting computers into the home, into the hands of the general public. So it's interesting to hear this, but it's also really quite interesting to hear. I listened to it earlier, and the interviewer is amazingly skeptical. Is just like, look, we've, you know, like, how is this any better? You know, I can already write things down on cards and file them. You know, what is this new gadget going to help? It's a solution looking for a problem. It's actually interesting to sort of hear the pushback against the idea that computers are anything but, you know, what big companies are going to want to do, statistics. So anyway, it's part of a program. We'll have a link, but it's part of the program, and so it starts in about 29 minutes in. So you can jump to the end as I did. I don't know who was interviewed before that.
Very cool. So I will make sure we have a link to that in the show notes. Nice. Nice one. I'm going to kick off my first of two pieces of interest I will be contributing to the show, both of which share something in common, which is I don't really understand them. So the first one, which I actually understand better than the second one I tell you guys, I'm going to throw it out there and see what if you understand what I'm linking to. But this first one is Specky Jam. And the Specky Jam, as far as I can tell, is a game. It's a week-long online event, because I don't think it's not like Kansas Fest where people are actually gathering together. It seems to be something that's going to last a week. It's going to go from the 29th of August through the 5th of September. And during that period, people involved in Specky Jam who sign up, and it's free to get involved, are going to create games. Now, you would assume, because it's the Specky Jam, that you're creating a ZX Spectrum game. But as far as I can tell, that's not the case. The goal here is to create a game that is like a ZX Spectrum game. So as far as I can tell, you make the game in whatever you want. Could be a Mac game, could be something for Android, could be a web thing. It can be anything you want. Doesn't have to run on a Spectrum, but it should look like it's running on a Spectrum. So the rules are not about platform as much as about implementation. There are particular colors you have to use. There's a particular resolution it has to run in, that sort of thing. Kind of strange. So I found out about it because they have announced the panel, and the panel are of people that will be judging these games, and there's some pretty good names there. Jason Austin's there, so he's the guy behind Altered Beast, and a game I used to like, Nemesis the Warlock. And Colin Jones as well, the fellow behind Rockstar Ate My Hamster. And so Jim Bagley's involved, who's Roadrunner, Red Heat. But like, I mean, and Clive Townsend, like these are big names who will be judging this. So that's really interesting. Although I still think I don't quite have my head around what this event is. So I've now said everything I have determined from the website and a couple of forum posts. Anybody out there know more about this? And have I got any of it wrong so far? Nobody? Nobody's heard of this thing. Okay.
This is new, but it looks very interesting. So like a mini Hackfest, but on steroids.
And it's an interesting approach to say we're going to make Specky games, but not actually on a ZX Spectrum. Just make things that look like they could have been, but using modern platforms. So, interesting. And so there you go. The Specky Jam 2, presumably this happened last year and I just didn't know about it, coming up August 29th through September 5th. We'll have a link to the site, which is just speckyjam.com, in the show notes.
I'm just trying to imagine Spectrum resolution on like a 24-inch monitor. I mean, those pixels are going to be big enough to hit somebody with.
Yep. So there you go. So, Michael, you are next. So what is this about the smartphone turning 20?
Well, it depends on your definition of a smartphone, but 16th of August 1994, so I suppose, you know, it's retro from a phone perspective. The IBM Simon has lots of features that we would consider essential to a PDA and also incorporate into a smartphone. So it had calendar, you could take notes, had a stylus, you could send emails and messages, and all on a cell phone. And it only weighed just over 1 pound. So,
oh, my gosh.
I just was coming across that one, browsing the BBC.
I've never even heard of this thing before.
No, I hadn't either. So
I like the industrial design, actually. This is pretty cool looking. I see the battery lasted up to 1 hour.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So
only 1.1 pounds.
1 hour battery, 1 pound weight, $900 price tag, and no actual mobile internet service. But still, I think this is pretty cool, and this is completely new to me. Never even heard this before.
Yeah. So it's interesting what you can find out there. Start off with this here. Now, I had a Sharp 8000 PDA before I had my Palm 3, but even that, we're still talking about Palm 3. I suppose a little bit 98, I think. Mm-hmm. For the Palm 3, the Palm Pilot prior to that, but 94. That I think this is pretty much right there on the beginning. And the thing is, it's incorporated with a mobile phone for such a long time. My philosophy was that a phone with PDA wasn't as good as a PDA. It wasn't until the Trio came along things started to sort of like gel that way. But I was always a separate PDA from a phone, and it wasn't until the iPhone 3G came out that I actually surrendered and used a single device as a phone and as a PDA. But it was interesting, as you said, I hadn't known about this one, and August 94, that was quite an impressive piece of tech, even if the battery life was a bit on the low side, but still, as far as size goes and what you could do with it, pity there was no real environment to use it in.
Very cool. Very cool. Nice. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, and I definitely urge listeners to go look at it, because just from form factor alone, it's really beautiful.
Yeah, it'd be nice to find out if anyone out there actually had one or still has one.
Call us on it. We'll keep the call under an hour. Earl, you are next. What have you got here? Something about the Living Computer Museum.
Yeah, so a week ago, Saturday, I went to the Vintage Computer Fair at the Living Computer Museum, and I had a great time. Saw some people that I knew there, and if you've been to a Vintage Computer Festival or one of the other computer get-togethers, like a local club meeting or something like that, this wasn't like that. This was a different sort of thing. It was put on primarily by the Living Computer Museum. So when you got there, there was one table in the vendor area that had an actual club represented, the Seattle Retro Computing Society. But aside from that, most of this was put on by the LCM themselves. Outside in the parking lot, when you first got there, there were eats, refreshments and that. There was also a very complete Doc Brown DeLorean. This was an awesome recreation of the DeLorean from Back to the Future, with steam coming out the back, the whole nine yards. It was just gorgeous. But once you got past that, you got onto the first floor. There's the gift shop. And I think this is a permanent fixture of the computer museum, where you could find shirts that I thought were really reasonably priced, and also a lot of books that we've talked about, including Dr. Steve's book on Apple II history. But past that, then you got to the first floor. There's the, as I mentioned, the Seattle Retro Computing Society had a table there. They had a couple pets set up doing a multiplayer game. With the user ports connected to each other. It was a lot of fun. There were also pinball machines, sit-down console arcade machines, so lots of things to play around with, and some other miscellaneous vendor booths. So you're standing there in the vendor booth talking to somebody, and all of a sudden a marching band comes walking through. There was live music there, and these guys were good. It was kind of loud. It was kind of hard to talk while they were playing, but they were very – they had a lot of energy, and it was – that just made for a festive atmosphere. Once you got done looking at all the stuff downstairs, you could go upstairs, which is, of course, the actual Living Computer Museum. And this is the first time that I'd been there since they've opened. It's great stuff. Lots of personal computers on the floor that you could sit down and play with. An original PET 2001 with a chiclet keyboard, an Atari, an Apple II, you know, all that stuff that you'd expect. And some bigger iron, like a PDP 1170, a PDP 8. And these were connected to some ASR 33 teletypes. So you could actually sit down at the old ker-chunk teletype and do some programming. And, or if you wanted the real snazzy experience, you could sit down at a VT100 terminal and program these things. There's a Sol 20 that you could sit down and actually play around with, an IMSI, lots of other stuff. I mean, this is stuff that I obviously can't afford in my collection and really got a kick out of being able to sit down and actually work with. And that's one of the main things of the Living Computer Museum is it's living. You sit down, you work on the stuff. There's a key punch where they were, you could sit down and key punch whatever you wanted and then take that away as a souvenir. It's interesting, I had to stand in line for the key punch and I had a serious deja vu from back in the 70s, standing in line waiting on the key punch. I was like, wow, this is like the good old days, except that in front of me, here's some millennials that are working on the key punch. They've probably never seen one of these suckers, but you should see the gleam in their eye. They were having fun typing stuff out and then taking it away. Also, you could go in the computer room, the quote-unquote computer room, with the real big iron, like the DEC System PDP-10, and walk up and actually see some of those old mainframes in operation. They had some fun things for the kids, too. Like decorate your own bit. There's a mascot of the Living Computer Museum that they call the bit. It's this little screen with arms and eyes on it and that kind of thing. They printed them out on a MakerBot. Have you guys ever seen a MakerBot?
I have, yes.
Those suckers are cool. So apparently it took about 1 hour each to print out these bit mascots because they were pretty big. But then you could sit down and color them with Sharpies and basically make your bit to taste. And I actually did that. You know, I had to join in the fun on that. Overall, this was just an awesome time. And it was nice that they opened it up at no charge. And it seemed quite well attended. At one point, upstairs in the museum, it was really busy. A big crowd walking around there. So thought I would report on that, say I had a great time. And if somebody is in the Seattle area and inclined on this retro computer stuff, should definitely stop in and see the museum because – man, it's just awesome.
Very cool. I like how you say the museum is alive. It's like, yes, bring me the children.
I will assimilate
them. As opposed to just hands-on. The funny thing is with the millennials, when their children go to the museum, it'll be mostly them remarking on, computers used to be something outside your body.
Remember before
this?
Cranial implants?
Yes. Yeah. Interesting. But they won't actually be physically at the museum with you. And we will be old. So, and speaking of old, Paul, talk to me about... No, not Paul being old. This documentary is old. From 1990, which has now, I guess, officially become the past. Oh, 1990 doesn't seem that long ago to me. So Douglas Adams, who has also passed. I'm bringing it all together. He has a documentary called Hyperland. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, I don't know actually that much about it since I must admit I kind of skipped around a little bit after the beginning, but it is basically a documentary where Douglas Adams has fallen asleep and sort of dreaming the future, and the future that he is dreaming is essentially the World Wide Web. You know, so he is convinced by Tom Baker, who when
my doctor.
You're right, exactly. He's playing essentially the web browser and sort of showing him, interconnected.
I would totally have Tom Baker as a web browser. I would drop Chrome in a heartbeat for Tom Baker.
I'll go for the Pertwee edition, if you don't mind.
Also a valid choice.
Right. But yes, no, it's pretty entertaining. It's actually the thing is, you know, so there's some sort of demonstration at the beginning about how you know, just sort of how you can connect, you know, information and, you know, retrieve things and skip around and get access to stuff that you normally wouldn't have access to. But then it actually is sort of like just swimming around on Wikipedia. So there's sort of all these sort of half finished, you know, bits of information about literature and you know, they're sort of documenting other things that have nothing to do with, you know, sort of just an example of information. But it's pretty interesting, and the thing that is sort of extra interesting about it is that the, you know, the actual first web browser didn't come out until just after this, so this is really sort of predicting quite accurately what's happening. So anyway, it's interesting to look at, and sometime I'll watch it all the way through, but it seemed you know, a neat set of people involved in a fairly, you know, sort of good predictive thing.
Very cool. I can see why Douglas Adams would be interested in this idea of, you know, doing, as you say, the falling down the Wikipedia rabbit warrens and leaping all over, because by this point, if this is 1990, he's already done Dirk Gently. And so he's now writing novels about the idea of interconnectedness of knowledge, of all things, of leaping around. And so it kind of makes sense that that would be the sort of thing on his mind when it comes to computers as well. Of course, he was such a massive Macintosh fan, such a massive fan of interface changes and graphical interfaces. So I think didn't he get the first Macintosh in the UK, and the second was Stephen Fry, or vice versa, something like that. So big fan of technology, and Apple technology in particular, it seems. This documentary really appeals to me, though. I've never watched it, so I'm looking forward to seeing this as soon as I finally hang up on you guys.
Right.
This is going to end up being a shorter show than we planned, and so that brings us to the end of actually, what it brings us to is my next piece of info, and as I promised, it will once again be something I don't actually understand. So I saw this mentioned on Reddit. Fellow who created this piece of software called Serial TCP for the Macintosh said, hey, there are things out there that allow you to route TCP connections to a serial port, so you can get old computers on the internet, but they're difficult to make work with classic Macs. And so he has put together his own piece of software called Serial TCP for Macintosh, and it's described as follows on the website. Serial TCP allows you to instantiate and send a TCP connection, a telnet session for example, to any available serial port on your Macintosh. It's perfect for linking retro computer hardware to the internet. That sounds really exciting, but I don't understand this. So it's software that only works under OS 10, in fact, 10.6 and up. So I guess it runs on a modern Mac, and somehow this lets you connect an older Mac through, like, I honestly don't understand. I downloaded the software thinking, oh, I'll read about it. It comes with nothing, not even a Hello World document. It's just, here's the app, run it, figure it out on your own. A bunch of questions were asked on Reddit, but none of them have been answered. So I'm not really sure what this does, but it seems to do something that probably our audience would be interested in. So I thought, well, somebody smarter than me will know how to make this, make old Macs get on the net, I guess. I'm not really sure, but it looks cool and it's free. So there you go. Has anybody else used this? Does anybody understand this better than me?
It looks interesting, but I'll have to get my 512K up and running. But yeah, you have basically read out all of the chunky part of the documentation. Oh, that is the documentation.
So what I think, my guess is this. My guess is on a modern Macintosh, you run this software, and it just takes your TCP IP connection and spits it out a serial port, which is essentially USB on a modern Mac. You would then, like they recommend here, you could use a USB to RS-232 serial adapter. Presumably that would then go to a modem. That's connect or a serial. No, I guess it would get into a serial port on an old computer, and there and Bob's your uncle. And then I guess that's what's happening here. I'm not really sure. I don't know. I'm linking to it anyway. I don't care if I don't understand what I'm talking about.
It would have been nice if it had a little bit of a for example, instance.
Yes, like something like that. But it still looks cool and it's got a good logo. So it's free. I think it's interesting. It's got a good logo. So that's my choice for number two. I don't want to pick it for news. And we'll have a link in the show notes for somebody else to figure out what I'm talking about. Michael, let's go back to you. And I like how you say here, can't have enough Cray. I agree with you completely. Talk to us about Cray stuff.
Okay. Again, just trawling through, it started off with linking across to the Inside HPC website, and they basically had a blog in there about a documentary DVD. I'm probably going to massacre this name. Chippewa Falls Museum of Industry and Technology had sponsored a DVD on Cray Research, which happens to be he's a local boy, local company, and commented that that DVD was out on YouTube and wanted to know if there was any way of buying the disc online. Of course, I couldn't resist infringing copyright and clicking on the link, which didn't take me to the DVD on YouTube, but to the actual Museum of Industry and Technology. So the DVD looks interesting. It wasn't hard to find it on YouTube, and yes, it is quite interesting, and I wouldn't mind buying it online, seeing I can't quite just pop over and buy a disc on the weekend. And then as things happen, you click on another link, and it took me to another YouTube, this time a playlist of four videos on Cray, one of which includes the video that we talked about previously. I'll just bring it up here, the Seymour Cray's Only Surviving Talk, Cray 1 Introduction. And it's another three articles in there. So on gallium arsenide as a substrate. And sorry about that. I just clicked play accidentally. there's plenty of videos out there. So if you have listened to our previous shows and left you with a sense of, I need to watch some more Cray videos, here you are. Here's a link to the DVD. Here's a link to the playlist. And if anyone does know of a way of getting my hands on that DVD online, might just have to send an old-fashioned email or letter and say, hi, I want to send you money, send me a disc.
Yeah, we're all sort of like clicking around.
Yeah, exactly. Click, queuing up. So back to the podcast. So Earl, you're up next. Single board computer kit. You had me at single board computer kit. Tell me about the P112.
So these have been pretty popular, and it's a Z80 based. It's a derivative of the Z80 chip based single board computer that runs an incarnation of CPM, actually an improvement over CPM. And I don't know a ton about it. I guess I'm keeping with the theme of the episode, that we're all talking about news stories that we don't really know anything about. I just know that
it's all gone downhill since David left.
On the CPM mailing list and in other places, the P112s have always been spoken about fondly. There's another run that's going to be available here. It sounds like 85 total might be produced. And the person producing them has also said this might be the last run ever. So if you were interested in getting one of the P112s, now would be the time to consider it. We'll have a link up in the show notes. The cost is $190. So it's a Z80 182 processor. That's a lot of numbers, so it must be good. It's got 16 megahertz clock speed. It's got serial parallel and disk I.O. built in. Like I said, it runs a derivative of CPM, new and improved. And all fits in about the form factor of a 3.5-inch disk drive. So pretty small and runs off 5 volts. And there is an active community around these. I'm not sure how big that community is, but definitely there are enthusiasts for this model. So again, check it out. If it's something that interests you, go find out more. And if you want, place an order, because now's the time.
Very cool. I remember at Kansas Fest, Paul, you might remember this as well, when Quinn did her presentation on the Veronica, afterwards she held up a single board computer that's coming out shortly that's based on the 6502. And I'm very, very keen on when that gets released. But I don't know when it's coming. And if anybody knows, I would like to find out, because I searched for it, couldn't find anything. I'd love to link to it in the show notes so that I can buy it when it comes available. Paul, do you remember that thing, what it was called?
From what I understood, it was... no, I don't remember who's making it. Whoever makes the 6502s now, there is a company that
oh, from Western Design?
Might be. But yeah, I think it's supposed to compete against... There are a couple of these little, you know, they're kind of like, I don't know, Raspberry Pi competitors or whatever, you know, the little kit things. And I think this was on the horizon. I think that this was actually sort of a prototype that Quinn had.
Huh. Well, if you are ever interested in building a 6502-based single-board computer, there is the MicroKim from Brill Computers. And that's a
But now we've seen what Quinn did. Like, if you don't start from bare bones and raw solder and just ability, then everything else is cheating. And so she's ruined it for the rest of us.
Oh, I'm just going to buy mine on eBay.
I should have just stolen the Veronica.
One of the contestants in the Retro Challenge had that 6502 homebrew computer that he'd made that he was trying to come up with a ROM monitor for.
Nice.
For the Retro Challenge. And that, I think, it wasn't breadboarded, but it definitely was homebrew, you know, not off of a pre-existing cookie cutter design.
Right.
So,
very cool.
Fun, fun, fun.
I agree. Fun, fun stuff. Okay, so we have a bit of extra news as well, which I'm going to run through really quickly. We had a couple of things contributed by Steve, even though he couldn't join us. It was very nice of him. And I think a bit of spare news here. I'm going to shout these out just so that we can make sure they get into the show notes. We'll run them through really quickly. The first is, and I think this is definitely worth mentioning, is a new BBS that's up and active on the Apple 2. It's using an Apple 2GS platform to actually run this thing. And it's called the Level 29 BBS. And it is currently live and accessible. And you can dial up to it with a real modem. And that's really exciting. It's a 415 area code. But you can also telnet to it. So you can just open a telnet session on your computer and get in. You can connect to it by raw sockets. And you can also just go modern and connect to it through a web browser. So if you head over to the website, and we will have a link to all this in the show notes, and that's really exciting. So there's currently a BBS. I connected to it really quickly and then left again. it needs more games, I think, but still very cool. Also a bit of spare news, which I think, Paul, in the show notes you were saying that you put this one originally about a very, very large computer arriving at Queen's Mary College.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is that?
Yeah, so I it's possible that we did link to this at one point. Yes, it's quite interesting. Basically, it's a movie. I think it's taken in 1968 from Queen Mary College, University of London, on the arrival of a large ICT 1905E mainframe. And it's a, you know, it's just sort of a nice little documentary of somebody. I think the post that I saw it on captioned it like some sort of, you know, very dramatic unboxing video. But it's essentially, they get this thing delivered by a truck, and they you know, get the cranes out, and they said the crane arrived in good time, and the weather was fine. The police came and gave the van a parking ticket, but it was sort of interesting to see. And I think one of the things that is kind of neat about it is that the video, it's actually looks like it was sampled off of film, but it's quite clean. I mean, it's. You can actually see this stuff really, really nicely. It's in motion, you know, and it's new, and you know. So I think the images are really interesting to watch, and so it's worth, you know, spending the whatever it is 15-20 minutes watching their massive ICT 1905E arrive.
Nice. So we will link to that in the show notes too. And then finally, another bit contributed by our alas absent co-host Steve was a neat little article over on Medium.com. in which somebody named Lauren Archer looks into the origins of using X as a little close button in modern GUIs. And so who really originated? My first thought was that, well, that comes from Next. And I read through the whole article here, and it doesn't even mention Next. And it says, nope, looks at, like, Windows, early Windows stuff, and looks at Atari things, and looks at Amiga, looks at early Mac operating system looks at the early Xerox stuff and finally determines that it is actually originates with the with Atari. But then somebody wrote in, I think, from who was a developer with Windows early and said, no, no, we borrowed it, and it definitely was from Next. And that's where it came from, and you should have looked at Next, and that's where it was from. So it has a correction now already built into it. But it's still a really interesting read, so it's neat that somebody goes in back and looks to try to forensically determine where does an element that's now very common, where was it originated? And so, yeah, it looks like the X in Next is where that comes from. So we will have a link to that in the show notes as well.
IBM put a lot of what it knows about computers into the new IBM personal computer. Not to make it complicated, but to make it simple. So it's easy to understand and easy to use. IBM made its personal computer to help a person be more productive, to help a person be more creative. And those are good reasons for a person to feel good. The IBM personal computer, coming to selected stores across the country.
And now it is time to buy me things. Everybody get ready to buy me things. So the first thing, of course, is the retro computing gift idea, which we will throw into our retro computing gift guide over at rcrpodcast.com. And I try to keep that as up to date as I can. I think it is currently up to date. And I am host this week, so I get to pick what I want everyone to buy me. And so essentially what I'm picking are a very simple, very common item, which are the Apple Rainbow logo stickers. And in particular, I like the static ones. Those are the ones that stick on with static, are easily removable, and are essentially reversed. So you can stick them, essentially they're used on in a car window. Why was this in mind? Because I want some because I recently got a new vehicle, and I was thinking, hey, I should have one of these on my car, or in my case, my Jeep. So that's why they were on my mind. I couldn't even count how many of these come through my hands in my life from various Macs that I have purchased, and I have none of them now that I have a vehicle I want to stick a sticker on. So I'll have a link to an Etsy site that sells the original ones, and there are tons and tons of variants available on eBay as well. Very, very cheap gift available for people if you are interested in getting rainbow stickered up. So now, here we go. Time for eBay auctions, more things people can buy. Let's go around the table. Paul, we'll start with you. What did you find on eBay that is worth a purchasing?
Well, okay, as usual, a couple different things. The first one that I wanted to mention was there's an IBM 5155, which is that's the portable PC. It's basically an IBM PC, but crammed in a box with a screen and a handle. It's actually a pretty, if you're interested in an IBM 5150, you know, the very original IBM PC, and you should be, because this is episode 81. although I think the 5155 is later, but not much.
Well, the 5155, to be precise, is a PC XT in a portable form factor.
Okay.
So you got a few more slots, although you can't use them because there's no room, because inside that case everything's all crammed in so much. But
yeah, it's quite ridiculous actually. There are slots there, and it really just looks, I guess they were reusing parts. I don't really know. There's nothing that can fit there. Anyway, it starts at 99 cents. There is one bid on it, and that seems reasonable. I have a tendency to kind of like these portable luggables, because you can sort of put them aside and not take up a whole lot of space with them. The other couple things that I wanted to just sort of point out, there was a nice acoustic modem, an Anderson Jacobson acoustic data coupler.
Useful.
Yeah, it probably isn't useful for anything. I think the power comes on.
Wait, no, there's that new we just talked about it. The BBS that's available.
Ah, yes.
So there you go.
So this probably goes at like 110.
Because I'd also need a normal phone line. I haven't had one of those in a lot of years too.
And something that has the shape that will fit in the
cupboard. An old phone. Boy, this BBS is becoming expensive.
But it's very cool looking. I mean, I think it's quite possibly just a display item.
So the phone goes on the side? That's interesting. How does it stay on?
I have not ever seen one quite like this, but it's
staple gun.
Maybe just push it up against the wall or something. And then the last one is just this weird thing. It's called a Vintage Bus Grantosaurus Rex card for a PDP 11. And it's basically somebody made some cards. The Grant card, as I understand it, is essentially a way to just keep the electrical connection going across slots. If you have a PDP 11 and have some, there's a slot you don't use, you put one of these in to keep the signal going. It's really nothing but just sort of connecting a couple of pins. So somebody made this, little dinosaur looking thing that has connectors on the edge, connectors on the bottom that you plug into the slot. And it's called the Grantosaurus Rex.
Nice.
The most ridiculous and most awesome thing
I know,
that I've seen in a long
awesome.
Time. And yes, that's true that, deck buses had multiple card edge connectors. So you might have some cards that were half width and some cards that are, full quad width or whatever. So if you had a mix, the right mix of those, you had to keep bus continuity. But who would have ever thought to produce something whimsical like this to do that? It is just great.
This is definitely one of the more interesting cards I've ever seen. That's great. Looking at the modem, it does occur to me that we've talked a few times about various things that people can buy to collect and display, and modems would be something that would be collectible if you just want to get them for the beauty of their industrial design. You can generally pick up modems very cheap because, frankly, they're kind of useless nowadays. So it would be something that somebody who is interested in retro collecting, it could be something that you could go into and try to collect a whole bunch of very neat-looking modems because the industrial design of them can be very attractive, just physically.
Well, there was a person posting on CC Tech recently that is putting together an old-school PBX with analog line connections so that he can simulate a BBS system all in one spot. It's not as much fun, obviously, as calling a BBS across the country or whatever, but this would give you the capability to actually show off, hey, look, I'm going to call, and oh, look, I'm answering, kind of thing.
If a company set that up as their internal intranet, I would work for that company forever. That would be the coolest company ever. That'd be great, because intranets suck. And so somebody implemented it that way, I'd be like, you know what, this is worth it, then. Awesome. Best modem I ever owned, I think, was this portable one. I don't even know who made it. It was that gray that the Macintosh had around the time of the Duos, and I used it with a Macintosh Duo of some sort, like a 2300, 230, whatever that one, something along those lines. And it was a very, very small modem that was essentially two little blocks. One for that would go on the, it was an acoustic coupler modem, but they were just individual bits. One for the part you speak into and one for the part you listen to, and they had a strap, and you could go to a phone and strap these onto the phone. So it was made to be as small a modem as you could possibly get for travel. And so it was a little remote modem. And I love that thing. I used to use that at a lot of payphones and things, so because it could strap onto any sort of phone.
Well, if you're going to be an old school hacker, that would have been the way to do it, right?
Absolutely.
Just walk up to a payphone, freak yourself a long-distance trunk, and then
strap on your modem.
Exactly.
It was a different world.
The early version of war driving.
Exactly. Okay, so back to the eBay choices. I'm up next. This is one, keeping with the theme, I'm a little confused about why somebody would want this, but at least I think I know what it is. So back when the Apple IIc was being developed, the case didn't exist yet, and so they had the motherboard, and so they placed the 2C motherboard, the developing motherboard, inside an Apple IIe case, and Apple produced an in-house adapter that essentially let the Apple IIe keyboard connect to a 2C motherboard. And the code name for the 2C during the prototyping phase here, according to the eBay auction, was the Lolly. Well, a fellow has built his own adapter by just looking at photos from before of how that worked, and there now is a one-of-a-kind handmade adapter to let you do essentially the same thing. If you want to stick a 2C motherboard inside a 2E case, here's the adapter to do it. He's called the adapter the Poly, so there'd be no chance of thinking it was actually a vintage item. Bunch of watchers. It has a buy-it-now of $35. It's a very unique item. So, I don't know, it really appeals to me. So it's called the Poly, and it's a one-of-a-kind Apple IIe keyboard to Apple IIc motherboard adapter, and it is functional, but handmade. So that is what I am selecting for my... So it's something really caught my eye, something different. Lots of watchers, but nobody's bit yet at $35. So there you go. Next up, Michael, what have you selected?
Well, going with the theme of all things Apple on eBay, well, not totally. If anyone wants the Apple II, this is it. This is a 1978 Apple II, complete with lack of ventilation slots. But it's very, very good example of how to sell on eBay. Great photos, a little bit arty, and a great collection of extras to go with it. So this is literally a get-it-and-go computer, and it also has a bit of a cute backstory. Not that that really worries me, but you know, good starting price, a little bit of interest in it so far. Okay,
I think this is going to go for a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, last Apple II auction on eBay that I was actually watching and wishing I had that kind of money to participate went for over $24,000. But
oh my gosh! Okay.
Yeah, it was one of those things, sort of like, oh, should I bid on this? And then suddenly my maximum bid was a long, long way away.
That happens to me a lot with software. I'll look at something and think, oh, I should bid on that. And then I'll forget about it. I'll look back later and think, oh, I should have bid. I'm like, it went for how much? I'm like, oh, well, then I wouldn't have been in the running anyway.
Yeah, let's put a zero on the end of what I was going to put in there as my maximum bid.
Yeah.
But so it's interesting to sort of see how the Apple IIs have started to appreciate that value. So we're still not talking anywhere near the Apple One range, possibly because there's a few more of them still kicking around. But yeah, they're starting to get in there. So if anyone wants to get on the Apple II bandwagon, you've got one there. It's got to be some of the real old 78 models to make it worth your while at the moment. But no, as I said, this one, I've got it mainly there for the photography that goes with it, the extras. It's a lovely piece of classic Apple II.
It did actually start, you know, so in the show notes, you had mentioned that it was, you know, it had a good, you know, good starting price, and it did. The starting price was 1 cent.
Mm.
But it is now, as we're looking at it, $1,500. one thing I just wanted to say, I'm pretty sure it's actually not very clear until you get to some of the pictures that are in the description. But this one isn't quite that old. That it has, it's not one of the first couple that's lacking the vents. Those were the ones that was the one I think that went for $24,000.
Yeah,
you know, that was very, very early. This is quite early. And it actually, it's interesting to see some of the software and stuff that comes with it. I mean, it's lots of these pieces are worth a lot on their own. So,
I would like one. I have a 2+ though, and I'm happy with it. So, yeah, listeners, if you've got them, send me your Apple IIs. Okay, Earl, let's round it out with a choice from you. What Apple II item have you chosen?
Well, as luck would have it, I chose a Commodore item.
Oh, combo breaker.
I'm really interested in this item. I don't know if I would buy it. It's kind of fascinating that it's got pros and cons. There is a similar item that you can get from Jim Brain's web store. I think it's Retro Innovations, if I remember right, that you can connect up the IEC bus, which is the peripheral bus on the Commodore systems, to an SD card and keep all your disk images there, like you can with a variety of different 8-bit computers. That is one of the solutions for the Commodore systems. This is different in that this doesn't just connect to that peripheral bus, but it also is a cartridge that connects in the cartridge slot, and it has some fast load software built right onto the cartridge. So this, to me, is a plus and minus. It's a plus in that if you want the fast load software, it's built right into this cartridge, and the cartridge looks cool. It's styled like the old Commodore 64 stuff, and it's got some buttons on there for switching your disk images and that kind of thing. The downside is if you get one that doesn't have the cartridge that just connects to the peripheral bus, then you can use that with any of the old Commodores, the VIC-20, the Plus 4, Commodore 16, that sort of thing. This, with the software, would only be compatible with a Commodore 64 and maybe a 128 in 64 mode. So that's a minus. The other plus on this, though, is that once it was inserted into the cartridge slot, it wouldn't just be hanging out to dry like the micro IEC device that you can get just kind of hangs out there on a cable. This would actually sit nicely in the cartridge slot, giving it a little bit of structural integrity as you pull the SD card in and out. So I don't know. I don't know about this thing. It's about the same price as the one that doesn't have a cartridge. So you would have to specifically want the things that this offers and not care at all about the incompatibility of this with some of the other Commodore 8-bits.
But if you were somebody who was just a Commodore 64 user and lover, and that's all you wanted it for, then there really wouldn't be that downside, right?
Right. You might want this instead. So, fascinating item. I think I'm going to try and learn some more about it, but I just thought it was interesting enough that I'd pick it as my eBay auction, and Commodore enthusiasts can take a look at it and see if it's something that they might be interested in, or, you know, if they'd want to go that other way.
Very cool.
Earl, but wouldn't it be considered unnatural to have a Commodore 64 load its software fast?
It would take you off guard, definitely. I think that was a comment that we saw in a mailing list recently. Somebody said we could
you're still loading that mailing list, aren't you?
I am, because I was loading it from a Commodore 64. Yes. Now keep in mind, the ROM upgrade Jiffy DOS made disk drives fast, so we love Jiffy DOS, but this gives you a fast load right on the cartridge. So it's kind of like a two-in-one. I don't know. I'm on the fence on this, but interesting device.
Very nice. Okay, good choices all. That brings us to the end of the show, unless anybody has something to add. We can go around the table really quickly. Does anybody have any retro goodness in their life that they want to contribute? Paul, anything to add?
I don't think so. I think just sort of continuing on my various projects and not having time for any of them. But so...
As is the case with all of us. What about you, Michael?
Well, I'm trying to keep going with my failed retro challenge. I don't want to leave that one just hanging until the next challenge comes around in 6 months. So I've just been doing a little bit of programming on that. But the rest of the time I've been spending trying to sort out the 8-bit bunker. It's one of those things you sort of pick up a box of books and magazines to sort and put onto the shelf and where they go, and then you realize that you've just spent the last couple of hours browsing through a couple of those books in the box and you haven't actually put anything on the shelf. So lost in my retro library at the moment.
Very cool. And Earl, what about you?
I'm trying to learn Commodore 128 assembly language. Ooh. Which is similar to Commodore 64, except that you've got all that extra RAM. It is fast. It's 2 megahertz, not just one. I know Carrington won't appreciate that because he says, who needs more than
one? That's a full wasted megahertz.
Exactly. But I did something completely useless, but it actually worked. I wrote a sector-based disk copy program. And you might think, well, why in the heck would you want to do that when 100 other people have done that? But it's part of a bigger project that I'm working on that I'm not going to talk about yet because it's all the things that I start and never finish. So if I actually finish this one, then I'll talk about it. But aside from that, it was fun trying to dig into the Commodore DOS and figure out how you request a disk sector and move it into a buffer and that kind of stuff. And the program actually worked, so yay. It was just dog slow, though.
What's the Commodore 128, what's the processor on that? It's not a 6502, is it?
It's not. It's an 8502.
Oh.
So it's very much like a 6502. It's just got some extra memory management stuff that makes it available or, you know, makes it able to take advantage of more RAM.
Right. Cool. Nice. Very good. For me, I will say that, weirdly, I have non-Apple II news. I have an Atari 800.
Yay!
Congratulations.
Yes, thanks to a listener. Well, pretend privacy of Natsu who it was. But yeah, just absolutely over the moon thrilled that I now have an Atari 800 and a drive and a bunch of stuff, and I'm very excited. I haven't really done anything with it but sit it on a desk and go, well, that's gorgeous, and we will see what comes of it. But I'm very, very excited to get playing in this Atari world that I have just sort of looked at from afar. The industrial design of the 800 just thrills me. It's one of the most beautiful computers ever, so my first time being hands-on with it, and I'm quite excited to see what I can learn from it.
And it arrived to you with no damage?
Yes, yeah, no issues at all. It's in my hands now. Everything is gold. Everything is good. I am a very, very happy Carrington.
Maybe you could write a Apple II emulator to run on it.
Well, you notice how I chose as the host gift the Apple Rainbow logo stickers. So now you see.
No, don't. No, please don't do that.
No, of course not. Of course not.
Well, you know, the 800 is so much faster. I mean, you probably could write an Apple II emulator on it, and it would have speed to spare. So,
my goodness. Oh, what have I done? What world have I opened up here? But, yeah, quite excited about it. So, and that's it. I guess that brings us to the end of this episode 81. If you have any feedback, for instance, if you have memories or thoughts about the year 1981 that we missed, fire them our way. Or if you've got thoughts on things we should definitely discuss about the year 1982, which we'll be talking about in our next episode, then definitely send those our way as well. And you can, of course, send us feedback by emailing us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. Or if you just head over to our website, rcrpodcast.com, you will find links to send us feedback. You will find links to discuss stuff in the forum. You will find all of our show notes. It's just a fantastic place. And even we'll let you jump off over to the Throwback Network, of which we are a member. Meanwhile, we really appreciate you taking this time, this hour and a bit, to listen to us old fogies ramble on about our distant memories of the head of retro computing. And thank you for listening. And until next time,
Retro Computers!
Well done, us.